GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Welcome. That's me, scientist, author, and environmental entrepreneur, and I'm the host for today's show.
I'm Bob Kessler, our executive producer. This week, we're going to get into glaciers. You know, Glacier National Park may not have any within our own lifetimes because of climate change. We'll meet an expert geologist on that, and also nuclear power plants at sea. Is that a terrible idea or a really good one? Well, either way, China's going to be doing it, it sounds like, so we'll learn more from the Union of Concerned Scientists.
All coming up on this week's edition of GreenSense. The glaciers of Glacier National Park in Montana could be gone in our lifetime. A report from the U.S. Geological Survey says that they're already shrunk by 40% in the last 50 years. Daniel Fegre, a research ecologist with the USGS Northern Rocky Mountain Science Center, says their fate is sealed and they'll be gone in the coming years. He joins us now on GreenSense. Welcome, Daniel.
Pleased to be here.
The last glacial period occurred from about 100,000 to 10,000 years ago, and during this period, glaciers advanced and retreated. And you've been interviewed by other media of having saying that these glaciers will be gone in our lifetime. Is there anything society can do, or is this part of a natural cycle?
So first of all, what's interesting is that these little glaciers are actually remnants of what we call neoglaciation, meaning that they actually disappeared after that ice age you're talking about, and then they reappeared about 7,000 years ago. And they've been with us on this landscape for about the last 7,000 years. And as you said, they've kind of grown bigger and gotten smaller. They've waxed and waned. But about 50 years ago, we started having much less snow. And snow is what nourishes glaciers, of course. And that was due to rising temperatures. And so, for instance, here in Montana, we now have our snowpack disappear about 30 days earlier. In other words, our winters are shorter. And with the less snow and the warmer temperatures, what we're seeing now is, at least in the context of the last 7,000 years, unnatural, because our glaciers are retreating very, very quickly, and they're shrinking at unsustainable rates.
You're talking about the 37 glaciers in and around Glacier National Park in Montana. The glaciers in Montana seem to be most impacted by climate change, while other glaciers in places like New Zealand and the Karakoram mountain chain along the border of India, Pakistan, and China are stable and may even show some signs of advancements, which I'm assuming is attributed to local variations in climate change. In your opinion, why are the glaciers in Montana so impacted while other glaciers are stable or may even be advancing?
So part of the reason that ours started retreating earlier than others and perhaps more severely is that the regional temperatures here warmed 1.8 times, that is almost double the global average. So we are in a regional hotspot, but many mountain areas in general are retreating, or the glaciers are retreating more quickly because many mountain areas have also warmed up, like the Arctic and the Antarctic, more quickly. And so a lot of this has to do with the fact that they were just cold environments to begin with, and so they're more sensitive to warming. And so for that reason, lots of mountain glaciers around the world are melting. For instance, in Alaska, 99% of them are retreating and only 1% are advancing.
Are the glaciers in Montana the canary in the coal mine?
To a degree. We're not that unique. For instance, the glaciers in the Sierras and in the Colorado Rockies have also undergone similar things. I think there's two things. One is, of course, that glaciers of Glacier National Park carries a certain irony if the namesake glaciers are disappearing. So I think people have paid a little more attention to that. But I think that the one important point here is that the glaciers are just part of a larger ecosystem. And so one of the reasons we study them is that they are the most visible and obvious and easy to understand markers for climate change. But that climate change is affecting the forests and the animals and everything else. So it's just more difficult to document and understand because there's more complexities there. But ice is a pretty simple signal. When it gets warm, it melts.
Close to 3 million people visited Glacier National Park last year to see that ice. Besides not being able to enjoy the glacier's natural beauty, how will the melting of the glaciers change the geomorphology and that sensitive ecosystem in the area?
So one interesting aspect of that is that glaciers are grinding the rock around them. And in doing so, they create what we call rock flour, which is very talcum powder fine rock material. It's just almost like a dust. And that gets in the water from the meltwater streams from the glacier and goes down to the lakes. And it makes the lakes this beautiful, beautiful turquoise blue color. So as the glaciers stop moving and are technically no longer glaciers because a glacier is ice that moves, they stop producing that rock flour, and so those lakes start to change color. So you can almost tell how active a glacier is by looking downstream at some of these lakes. And so those are very beautiful and on all the postcards, and you know, people really, really resonate with that. So that will change. But perhaps more importantly, because that's maybe an aesthetic issue, is that downstream from glaciers, there are aquatic organisms that are adapted to extremely cold temperatures. And so in August, when all the seasonal snow is gone, those streams would either dry up or get a lot warmer if they didn't have the safety valve of these glaciers producing cold, cold water as they melt in the late summer sun. So we'll see some downstream cascading effects on other organisms in the ecosystem once these glaciers disappear.
I live in the Midwest. You know, the Great Lakes are a remnant of the glaciers. They created, you know, great natural beauty and a great economic resource here. Do you see the glaciers out there creating any new lakes?
No, at this point, it's too late. They're too tiny. So they are draining into existing lakes like Lake McDonald that, as you pointed out, were a product of the last glaciation that ended, 10 to 12,000 years ago. So those monster glaciers did scour out these big lake basins, and those are now filled with water. But our little glaciers right now are really too small to do that much more work on the landscape.
Did you see the movie Chasing Ice?
I did.
Yeah, we had James Balog on the show and went to his premiere opening, and you could see just how he was able to capture how the great glaciers have shrunk through that time-lapse photography. Your research shows that a lot of this is the result of climate change. And one of the biggest problems we have in the country, and this is something that James Balog also mentioned, is the divide between climate change deniers and those who acknowledge its existence. In your opinion, you're out there, you know, with these glaciers and in that natural beauty. How do we best bridge this divide?
Well, our role as U.S. Geological Survey scientists is to produce the best information and put it out there for policymakers, politicians, civic leaders, and the general public to make appropriate social decisions. We don't get involved in policy. Our job is to be a very neutral provider of the best possible information. So that's kind of our role in the national debate at this point.
And I can attest as a former geologist that the USGS has always been an objective broker of information and has put together very solid, non-politically based reports. Have you put out any information recently that is either pro or anti-climate change?
Well, the information that accompanied the data release is significant in that we were able to use new satellite imagery, new technology, and we got an unprecedented look in detail at these glaciers. And so while it continues the story of glaciers disappearing, we're applying better and better means for, getting the information and presenting it visually to people. So I think that's a pretty significant new data release that we hope will add to, as I said before, the sort of national debate on the effects of climate change.
Well, if anyone in the audience has not seen a glacier, I encourage you to go out and see them now. They're majestic. They're filled with vibrant colors and sounds, and they create a unique ecosystem, as Daniel just mentioned. So, Daniel, in your opinion, what should everyday people do in their everyday lives to help the climate change issue?
Well, obviously, if they're motivated, there are many outlets for information on what to do. These glaciers are only going to respond to changes in the global climate. And so it's not going to be effective to do anything locally, such as has been done in Switzerland, where they put some insulated material on a small glacier that they needed because it was part of a ski area. Our glaciers are out in the wilderness, and it'd be cost prohibitive. So really, it is scaling up to the need for global efforts to stop the rise in temperatures. At this point, our glaciers are existing in an environment that's too warm for them to survive. So we would have to have a major cooling for them to stabilize and last. So these glaciers may have their fate sealed, but you can extract a good lesson from the fact that they're going away, and that is that people can actually change the planet.
That's Daniel Fagre, a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. It takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep Green Sense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you.
There have been reports of floating nuclear power plants being developed by China in order to power islands in the South China Sea. Are these floating Chernobyls, or an example of a viable power source that the world may want to emulate? David Lochbaum is the director of the Nuclear Safety Project with the Union of Concerned Scientists and joins us now on Green Sense. Welcome, David.
Hello, Robert. Glad to be with you.
In simple terms, tell us the advantages of building a floating nuclear power plant.
Well, one of the key advantages is you can build them at a central facility where you can have quality control to make sure that once you get it right, every one off the assembly line is also right. It's challenging to go to remote sites around the country and maintain that same level of quality.
What are the risks, besides the obvious ones?
Well, the risks are that a barge is susceptible to some more extreme weather than the land is. The land's susceptible to earthquakes and landslides and things like that. Barges have their own challenges that they must be designed against to properly manage that risk.
What about accidental releases of radiation? It would seem that if you're out at sea, it's hard to monitor and protect and enforce environmental regulations.
It's different, but it's not insurmountable. For example, the U.S. Navy uses a lot of nuclear-powered warships, submarines, and surface ships that also have environmental when they come into ports. The releases from those vessels are monitored to make sure that safety is prepared. Similarly, barges can be subjected to environmental monitoring to ensure that they abide by all the rules as well.
But when they're out to sea, who's monitoring the monitoring?
Well, the Jack Cousteau Society got involved a few years ago when people proposed dumping nuclear waste in their oceans. So there are a lot of people that are concerned about what's done to the oceans. For example, after the Fukushima accident in Japan, China get very upset that release radiation was getting into the oceans that could someday affect Chinese shores. So there's an awful lot of people have a vested interest in the oceans and making sure that the wrong stuff doesn't get there.
Well, that's really good to hear, because that would be my next obvious question is, after Fukushima, floating nuclear power plant sounds like it would be difficult to get the public to support. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, nuclear power, because the mushroom cloud is generally the first impression people have of nuclear energy, is a difficult sell, whether land, sea, or air. The recent accidents make that sales job a little bit harder. But the flip side of it is, if you have more control over the quality and can better manage the risk, then the sales job becomes perhaps a little bit easier. And if you can also show that the benefits that are to be derived from nuclear power on a barge or on a ship are worthwhile, then people can sometimes accept that risk if they understand it's being managed, and realize what the benefits will be. It's a little bit easier for the sales job to go through.
Many of these floating plants are proposed in the South China Sea. How are they designed to withstand a typhoon and prevent a nuclear release?
It depends on how deeply they're anchored. For example, there was a floating nuclear power plant sold to a utility in New Jersey that was going to be anchored about 3 miles offshore of Atlantic City. In that case, they were going to build a rock breakwater around the facility to protect against something like the 100-year typhoon, 100-year winds, storm surge. And that breakwater was going to level, you know, protect the harbor inside, which housed the nuclear power plant, from those hazards. So, and for if it's further offshore, it'd be similar to offshore drilling rigs that are designed to handle severe weather.
Give us an idea on the costs of building a floating nuclear power plant versus putting one on land.
Well, the cost, if you built them at the individual locations, the cost would be higher than a land-based facility, because it's challenging to get the workforce to the construction site. But if you build them at a centralized location where the workforce is there and kind of cranking out, similar to cranking out cars at an assembly line, you can lower the individual costs if you build a lot at the same facility. So that's the advantage of doing it, if you're able to take advantage of the centralized construction location.
And why would you have to put a floating nuclear power plant in a remote sea location?
A lot of times it has to deal with the terrain there. Do you have the ability to, the footprint on land to build a facility? If you do, does that footprint provide protection against seismic activity, volcanic activity, and landslides and other things that can affect a land-based facility? The other reason that is sometimes used is that it's not meant to be a permanent or a long-term facility. It's there for a short period of time to help transition till the grid gets built on land or whatever. So both of you have some advantages, both from the geology as well as the time horizon that the facility is intended for.
If you just joined us, my guest is David Lochbaum, director of the Nuclear Safety Project with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we're talking about floating nuclear power plants here on GreenSense. I'm Robert Colangelo. David, this idea has been around for a while. The U.S. considered building these back in the 70s. Give us a little history and why it was abandoned.
Well, back in the 1970s, the Westinghouse Electric Corporation, which builds a lot of land-based plants, teamed up with Tenneco Shipbuilding to form Offshore Power Systems that was going to build floating nuclear power plants in Jacksonville, Florida, for customers either close to oceans or on large rivers where you could float the barge up the river and locate it. They actually sold two reactors to a utility in New Jersey for anchoring off of about 3 miles offshore of Atlantic City. Those plants were canceled, along with literally dozens of other plants, in the late 70s and early 80s. those plants were ordered assuming we'd have a 4% or 5% growth per year in electricity demand. And also in that period of time, the interest rates went up to double digits. So a lot of a high cost with low demand for your product led to those plants and others being canceled.
Could floating plants be a viable, safe source of energy for the U.S. now, now that technology is improved?
What the U.S. is considering in lieu of that is a similar concept, the standardized designs, modular designs, where you get the benefits of centralized manufacturing. But to go into smaller reactors, because the water-based ones have a limited number of options where they can be sold. So the vendors are looking at designs that allow them to be used at more locations and therefore more potential customers, a larger market, if you will.
Nuclear power in the U.S. leveled off starting in the 90s. At GreenSense, we think it can be clean, safe source of power if we use the new smaller plant design that you were talking about with a well-thought-out waste disposal plan. Early in my career, I worked with Argonne National Labs, and one of the things we worked on in the 90s was nuclear waste repositories to put all this waste. I'm not quite sure that that's ever quite been solved out there. So that's always remained an issue. Before Fukushima, there was talk of a nuclear renaissance in the U.S., but Fukushima changed that. Any chance we could consider a move towards more nuclear power plants?
The industry is looking at that, yes. Even despite the bump on the road that Fukushima represented, there are four nuclear reactors currently under construction in the United States. Companies are looking at perhaps building some more. But the flip side of it is we're looking at extending the life of the existing plants. Just last week, there was a meeting at NRC headquarters where two owners are looking at extending the life of their plants from 60 years to 80 years. About 87 of the nation's 99 reactors have already received 20-year extensions to their operating licenses, and now there's an option of perhaps even granting an additional 20 years. The downside from extending the life of the existing reactors is you put off the need for replacement power from any source, nuclear or non-nuclear. So the success of the industry in extending the life of the existing reactors has somewhat diminished the need for new nuclear power plants or new power plants of any type.
And it's also slowed the acceptance of the new technology because the new designs for these nuclear power facilities, from my understanding, are much more efficient. And especially if you can build them smaller and closer to the consumer, you lose a lot less power during transmission.
It's true. When I'm talking to many of the plant owners about why they chose to extend the life of a 60s or 1970s vintage plant as opposed to buying a brand new reactor is the uncertainty. Some of those new reactors look good on paper, but have never been road tested, if you will. So it's difficult for plant owners to invest billions of dollars into something that may or may not work. It's easier for them to justify spending money on extending the life of something that they've been running for a number of decades, and they know what its strengths and weaknesses are.
Let's go back to the waste issue. Where does all the nuclear waste go, and have we finally come up with a methodology for safely depositing that?
Currently, the waste remains at the plant sites where it was generated. A few years ago, the Department of Energy submitted an application for a repository at the Yucca Mountain site in Nevada. Due to politics and a number of reasons, that application was withdrawn. Now there's some talk in Congress about resubmitting that, starting that process over, see if the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would find that site acceptable for the long-term or essentially permanent disposal of nuclear waste. There's also two companies that are looking at interim storage sites where waste from around the country could be shipped to these sites, one in New Mexico and one in Texas, to store the waste there until the repository comes open. That would allow some of the nuclear plants in the United States to shut down, and the only thing left is the spent fuel. That would allow the spent fuel or the waste to be removed from those legacy sites and put in a place that's intended for its long-term storage.
Yeah, that sounds like that issue is still not solved. As I said, I worked on that a long time ago, and it was always a political football. and transporting.
Well, it's really your fault getting away from it. The reason we haven't made any progress. Right. I'm blaming it on you.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask a closing question here. You know, science has recently been in the news as people around the world march to defend the role of science in policy and society. And we need an honest broker of scientific information that's nonpartisan and objective so that we can make fact-based decisions to shape policy and create a better society. And that all sounds good in theory. However, in practice, science needs funds to finance research and take us beyond the boundary of the known. And there's the rub, the confluence of people, money, and science. So in three words or less, what are your thoughts on keeping science pure and objective? Just kidding about the three words.
I think transparency is a big issue. If one is transparent about what their statements are, what their positions are, and reveal any biases they have in terms of funding sources, et cetera, then the decision makers can properly weigh that input and reach the decision that benefits society the most.
Other thoughts out there on how to maintain that objectivity in science and keep it focused on peer research?
Well, I think, again, the transparency is a big issue because science implies that there's a black and white decision, and it's not always that black and white. Some issues you can always get more safety if you spend more money. So you need to be able to, decision makers need to be able to figure out what's the best investments to protect people. And I think if scientists are transparent about what they believe and why they believe it, that best enables decision makers to make the right informed decisions that help us all out.
David, thanks for joining us on Green Sense. Really appreciate your thoughts on this subject, and we really appreciate you taking a complex issue and explaining it in a very easy to understand way.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate it.
That's David Lochbaum, Director of the Nuclear Safety Project with the Union of Concerned Scientists. I'm Robert Colangelo, reminding you to subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Green Sense. Send any comments or suggestions or ideas to me at robert@greensenseshow.com. Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play by visiting greensensefarms.com and view the list of radio stations that air our show. Our goal is to be an honest broker of sustainable information so that you can make informed decisions. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan at Green Sense Farms, the largest indoor commercial vertical farm in the world. We walk the walk and talk the talk, growing leafy green vegetables 24/7, free of pesticides, herbicides, with non-GMO seeds, conserving resources, and reducing waste. Watch us grow. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.